Vaikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious, Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Vaikatra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we're plunging into, one of the biggest names in history, the Roman Empire.
Absolutely. And when we think of Rome, you know, most people picture the usual things.
Right. The marble statues, those incredibly straight roads, the law codes, maybe the aqueducts.
Yeah.
And that famous piece, the Pax Romana.
It's a powerful image,
Yeah. Definitely.
But it's also, let's say, heavily curated, almost sanitized.
Sanitized, yeah, that's a good word for it.
And our deep dive today, it's based on Christopher Kelly's book, The Roman Empire, a very short introduction. And what Kelly does is systematically, well, strip away that romantic view.
To show us what was underneath.
Exactly. Mm. To show us the actual system, the mechanics that kept Rome going for, what, five centuries?
Okay, so let's unpack that. Our mission here is really to get behind that impressive facade and try to understand the, well, sophisticated but often pretty ruthless engine that powered this ancient superpower.
Right. Kelly argues it wasn't just about military victories, you know, legionaries marching everywhere.
No.
No, it was a highly efficient, maybe even brutal, system of economic exploitation.
Mm.
It was all held together by a surprisingly low-cost government.
Low-cost for an empire that big.
That's what he calls it, a minimalist state.
A minimalist state. Okay. So the big question we're tackling then is...
It's really this paradox, isn't it? How did this one single city manage to conquer and then, you know, govern the entire Mediterranean world for so long?
And crucially, what was the real cost? The often hidden price paid by all those different peoples in the provinces who were essentially funding the whole operation.
Yeah, we're looking for the operating manual, maybe, not just the highlight reel of emperors and battles.
And the guide providing that manual is Christopher Kelly. So tell us a bit about him. What makes his take on Rome so, well, different?
Okay, so Kelly is a professor of classics and ancient history at Cambridge, a leading authority.
Right.
But the key thing is his specialty, the later Roman Empire. So think roughly from the 3rd century AD onwards.
Ah, okay. Because a lot of the popular histories tend to focus on the earlier Golden Age, right? Augustus, the Antonines.
Yeah, exactly. They often kind of trail off after the 2nd century.
So why does looking at that later, maybe more turbulent period, change the whole perspective?
Well, it gives them the long view. By studying that period of... intense pressure, crisis, and eventually transformation like in the 400s, he can see more clearly which parts of the Roman system were truly essential.
And which parts were just sort of window dressing.
Precisely. He gets away from that simple narrative of rise and fall, you know, glorious beginning, inevitable collapse.
Instead, he's asking different questions.
Yeah. Questions like, how did the system itself adapt? How did it manage violence and extract resources for such an incredibly long time?
So he's bringing a more modern, maybe a more critical eye to it, looking less at, say, the genius of individual generals.
And more at institutional resilience, how power actually worked.
Yeah.
And importantly, how it was justified.
He's really asking, okay, Roman civilization was impressive, but who actually benefited?
Right. And who ultimately paid the bill?
That does sound provocative.
It is, because it forces you, the reader, to grapple with this uncomfortable idea. Rome's success wasn't some kind of benevolent gift to the world.
It wasn't magic.
No. It was based on, well, ruthlessly applied institutional efficiency and control. Hard-nosed pragmatism.
Okay. So that makes the book less like a story, a chronological history, and more like an intellectual toolkit. Something to help us rethink what we think we know about how Rome was run.
That's the perfect way to put it. Kelly's main argument really revolves around that core contradiction in Roman rule.
The contradiction being?
That they were, on the one hand, the source of things we still admire. Ideas about law, incredible engineering, this unifying Mediterranean culture.
But on the other hand...
They were also an engine of, frankly, immense violence, huge social inequality, and pretty systematic oppression.
Wow. So the book takes that contradiction apart.
Yeah, it dissects it by looking at the main pillars. The military power, obviously, but also the economic model, which was basically plunder and taxation. The rigid social structure, you know, the winners and losers. And finally, the ideologies they used to keep it all together. Things like the imperial cult and later how Christianity fit in.
Right. So to really get how the system worked, we probably need to start with how they governed. And this is where Kelly brings in that idea you mentioned, government without bureaucracy.
Yes, this is fascinating.
How do you run a massive empire on the cheap? It sounds impossible.
Well, Rome basically just refused to build or pay for a large central civil service.
Really? No thousands of administrators, no complex departments like we have today.
Nope. They lacked all of that. Mountains of paperwork, salaried officials everywhere. That wasn't the Roman way. They were, as Kelly puts it, the ultimate minimalist state.
That just seems counterintuitive. How did they enforce rules, collect taxes across, Britain to Syria without a proper bureaucracy?
They outsourced it. Radically outsourced.
Outsourced to who?
To the locals. Power was basically devolved down to the provincial level. Using this really pragmatic strategy, Kelly calls it a kind of franchise operation.
A franchise operation? Like a fast food chain?
Sort of. Rome provided the brand, the military protection, the prestige, the legal framework, the Roman name.
Okay.
But the actual day-to-day work, the heavy lifting, that was done by the local elites in the cities and towns across the empire.
You mean the wealthy families, the aristocrats in places like Gaul or Greece or North Africa?
Exactly, those people. Rome essentially cut a deal with them.
What was the deal?
You get to keep your wealth, your local status, your influence. In fact, we'll probably enhance it.
And in return?
You keep the peace in your area, you fund local public works, temples, maybe an aqueduct, and most importantly, you collect the taxes for us and make sure they get sent back to Rome.
Wow, so it's a partnership, but a very unequal one.
Oh, deeply unequal, but symbiotic. It was incredibly cost-effective for Rome. The local elites maintained their dominance. They got perks like Roman citizenship, maybe even a shot at high office in the imperial system.
And Rome didn't have to pay for thousands of administrators out in the provinces.
Precisely. It insulated the central government in Rome from all that complexity and cost.
There's that famous correspondence, isn't there, between Pliny the Younger when he was a governor?
And Emperor Trajan. Yes, it's a perfect example.
What does it show?
It shows just how minimalist the central administration was. Pliny is writing back to the emperor himself, asking for permission on incredibly minor local things.
Like what?
Like, should he approve the formation of a local fire brigade? Can he fix a town's drainage system? Really mundane stuff. He wasn't asking for legions or grand strategy advice.
He had to ask the emperor about a fire brigade.
It's quite astonishing, isn't it? It shows how little delegated authority there was. There was no real middle layer of specialized bureaucracy to handle these things. Decisions relied on the emperor's personal say-so, often on an ad hoc basis.
So if a top governor like Pliny needed the emperor's okay for that sort of thing, imagine how little autonomy anyone lower down the chain had.
Exactly. It really highlights that minimalist core.
Okay, so that minimalist state model, governing on the cheap, leads us right into the next bit. The economy. Because if the governing was cheap...
The goal was definitely to extract wealth. Ruthlessly.
Yeah, Kelly calls this an economy of systematic exploitation. That sounds pretty stark.
It is, but it's probably the honest truth about Rome's finances. I mean, think about the early expansion. How was that funded?
Conquest. War.
Pure plunder. Massive hauls of gold, silver, treasure, huge amounts of land confiscated, and of course, hundreds of thousands of people enslaved and taken as war booty.
Okay, but what happened when the empire stopped expanding? When it reached its limits, say, under Hadrian or Trajan, they couldn't rely on plunder forever.
Right. That's when the model shifted fully to relentless, systematic extraction through taxation.
Taxation. We all pay taxes. What made the Roman system so effective or brutal?
Well, for one thing, it was pretty much inescapable.
Mm-hmm.
And it was tied directly to the essentials. People and land.
So what kind of taxes are we talking about?
The two main ones were the tributum capitis, basically a poll tax, a tax on each individual person.
Okay.
And the tributum soli, which was a tax on land, particularly agricultural land.
And who collected these taxes? Not Roman officials, if the state was minimalist.
No, exactly. It was administered locally by those same collaborating elites we just talked about.
Ah, the franchisees.
Right. And they often had strong incentives, shall we say, to collect more than was strictly required. Skim a bit off the top, maybe.
So if you're just a regular farmer in, say, Egypt or Gaul, you probably didn't see many benefits from being part of the empire.
For most people, no. What you saw was a heavy annual tax bill that took away a significant chunk of your harvest, your surplus.
And where did all that wealth go?
It flowed towards the center. It paid for the massive army that was the biggest expense. It funded the administration back in Rome, the emperor's court, the grain dole, for the city's population.
And all those grand building projects we still admire, the Colosseum, the aqueducts, the temples.
Exactly. Kelly is pretty blunt about this. Those famous roads and monuments. They were essentially built with the surplus wealth squeezed out of provincial farmers, people who would likely never even see Rome.
And underpinning this whole economic system, slavery.
Absolutely fundamental. It wasn't just, a small part of the economy. It was foundational.
For what kinds of work?
Everything. Agriculture, especially the largest states or latifundia. Mining, which was brutal work. Domestic labor in wealthy households. Construction. The constant flow of captives from wars kept the system supplied.
So slavery allowed the elite to amass the wealth they needed.
To maintain their status, build their villas, and crucially, to play their part in that franchise deal with Rome. It all connects.
This leads us straight into what Kelly calls the world of winners and losers, because the system clearly wasn't benefiting everyone equally.
Not even close. The wealth and power were incredibly concentrated, hyper-concentrated, really.
So who are the winners?
The tiny elite at the very top, the senatorial families, the equestrian order in Rome, maybe less than 1% of the total population.
10%.
Yeah. And then also those collaborating wealthy aristocrats out in the provinces. They were the junior partners, but they still reaped huge benefits compared to everyone else.
And the losers.
Pretty much everyone else.
Yeah.
The vast majority of the population.
Like who specifically?
The rural peasantry, often trapped in debt or working someone else's land as tenants. The urban poor in the cities, struggling day to day. And of course, the enormous population of enslaved people who had basically no rights at all.
Kelly uses this really stark division, this winners and losers framework, to explain other big changes later on, doesn't he?
Yes, absolutely. He connects it directly to things like the eventual rise and triumph of Christianity, but we'll maybe get to that.
Okay. But hold on. If the system was so exploitative, so unequal, how did it last for 500 years? Surely it wasn't just brute force and extraction. Rome must have offered something positive to keep people, well, if not happy, at least compliant.
That's a crucial point. And this is where Kelly points to Rome's real genius, maybe. It wasn't just domination, it was also integration.
Integration? How so?
They were masters at turning conquered peoples, or at least their elites, into stakeholders in the Roman
How
project.
did they do that?
One key way was offering Roman citizenship. It started restricted, but over time it expanded. And citizenship offered real legal rights, privileges, status. It was incredibly desirable.
So it was a path upwards for provincials.
For some, yes, especially the wealthy and cooperative ones. Rome also often respected local customs, religions, languages, as long as they didn't challenge Roman authority or, crucially, tax collection.
So it wasn't always about imposing Roman culture wholesale.
No, there was a lot of cultural mixing, synthesis. They understood that ruling purely by force is expensive and unstable in the long run. By integrating local elites, by offering them a stake, they made the system more resilient.
So they made cooperation seem worthwhile, at least for those who already had some status, offering stability, the Pax Romana.
Even if, as we said, that peace was ultimately guaranteed by the very army their taxes were funding. It was a clever, pragmatic balance.
And this capacity for integration, for adaptation, is that why Kelly argues against the idea of a sudden fall of Rome?
Exactly. He really pushes back against that traditional narrative focused on the year 476 AD, when the last Western Roman emperor was deposed.
He says that wasn't the end.
Not really a sudden collapse, no. He sees it as the culmination of a long, complex process of transformation.
Transformation into what? Can you clarify that?
Sure. So in the western part of the empire, things certainly changed dramatically. Central Roman administration dissolved, the military command fragmented, power shifted to various successor kingdoms, Franks, Goths, Vandals.
Right.
But crucially, Roman law, Roman administrative structures, Roman culture, Latin. These things didn't just vanish, they formed the very foundations of medieval European society.
So the legacy continued just in different forms.
Precisely. And even more importantly, the eastern half of the empire, centered on Constantinople.
The Byzantine Empire.
Yes, that didn't fall at all in 476. It adapted, restructured, and continued to thrive, arguably, as the Roman Empire for another 1,000 years.
Wow, 1,000 years.
So the Roman institutional framework, the ideas, proved incredibly durable. They just changed their outward appearance, their packaging, you might say.
Okay, that perspective really shifts how you think about the end of Rome.
It does.
And Kelly's book is packed with these kinds of sharp, almost unsentimental insights, quotes or ideas that really stick with you.
Absolutely. They force you to reconsider the standard view.
Let's talk about a few. One that really stands out is his take on the Roman peace. The Pax Romana, the celebrated Roman peace, was conceived in violence, won through brutal conquest, and maintained by a military machine.
Yeah, that cuts right through the romanticism, doesn't it? It's a necessary corrective. We admire the stability Rome brought. But that stability wasn't freely agreed upon. It was imposed. Well, it was an enforced military peace. If anyone challenged the system, internally or externally, the legions moved in, often brutally. The peace existed because of the military threat, not in spite of it.
Stability isn't always nice.
No. It served Roman interests first and foremost.
Okay, another key insight connects back to governance, that analogy mentioned. The Roman Empire was not run by a vast army of civil servants, but was effectively a franchise operation.
Where the central government outsourced the day-to-day work to its partners, the wealthy elites of the provincial cities.
That franchise operation idea is just brilliant. It perfectly captures that low-cost elite collaboration model.
It does. They didn't try to reinvent the wheel everywhere. They just co-opted the existing local power structures. Very pragmatic.
And then there's his insight about Christianity's success. He links it directly to the social structure.
Right. He argues the triumph of Christianity succeeded because it offered a powerful message of hope to the empire's vast population of losers.
Hope for what?
Hope for equality, at least in the eyes of God. Mm. Hope for salvation, for justice in the afterlife, for belonging in a community that valued them regardless of their earthly status.
So he sees the religion's appeal as directly related to the harsh realities of inequality and exploitation within the empire.
Exactly. It's a compelling argument connecting that huge social stratification we talked about with the massive religious shift that ultimately reshaped the Roman world and its legacy. It provided a kind of spiritual solace or alternative for those the system left behind.
That's powerful. Okay, so thinking about all this, the minimalist state, the exploitation, the integration, the winners and losers, how does looking at ancient Rome through this very practical, maybe even cynical lens help us today? Are there real life applications?
Oh, definitely. Kelly's analysis of that minimalist franchise state is incredibly relevant, actually.
Yeah.
Think about modern governance debates.
Like what?
Debates about centralization versus decentralization. How much power should the central government hold versus local regions or authorities? How big should the state bureaucracy be? Rome offers a fascinating, if extreme, historical case study.
And maybe even beyond government, in business.
For sure. When you see large multinational companies expanding, how do they often do it? They set up local subsidiaries or partnerships. They maintain central control over branding, finance, maybe core strategy.
But they delegate the operational stuff, the day-to-day running, the risks often, to local partners or franchisees.
Exactly. It's a similar logic. Leverage local knowledge and resources. Keep central costs down. Kelly's Roman model teaches us to always look for those underlying systems of control.
To ask, who really holds the power? Who sets the rules? Who benefits? And who bears the cost and risk, regardless of the official structure or the PR?
Precisely. Another application is about institutional resilience.
How so?
Look at how Rome managed to survive huge crises like the chaos of the 3rd century AD. Emperors like Diocletian and Constantine didn't just try to patch things up. They fundamentally reformed the system. The military, the administration, the currency.
They adapted.
They adapted significantly. Mm. It shows that long-term institutional success isn't about being rigid or perfect. It's about having the capacity to evolve, to change core features even, without completely losing your essential identity. Flexibility is key.
That seems very relevant today with so many rapid changes happening.
Absolutely. And maybe one final broader application.
Yes.
Kelly's critical approach itself. Reading him encourages us to apply that same kind of questioning, that same unsentimental scrutiny, to our own national stories and myths.
To look beyond the celebratory narrative.
Yeah, every nation, every civilization has its achievements, its moments of glory. But they also usually have histories of exploitation, violence, injustice. Kelly shows us it's possible and necessary to acknowledge both sides, get a more honest, more complete understanding of the past, and maybe the present too.
Okay, so as we wrap up this deep dive, what's the biggest takeaway for you from Kelly's analysis of Rome?
For me, it's the stark reminder that the empire's undeniable success and longevity weren't accidents, and they weren't gifts. They were the result of a highly pragmatic, ruthlessly effective system. A system built on military power, yes, but crucially, also on elite collaboration and efficient exploitation. The sheer efficiency, even if brutal, is the real story behind the marble facade.
And for me, it's the idea of the enduring legacy. It's not really the emperors or the battles that shaped the world long term. It's the institutional stuff, the adaptable legal ideas, the administrative models, the cultural frameworks that proved so durable, they influenced civilizations for centuries after the Western Empire itself was gone. The software outlasted the hardware, in a way.
That's a great way to put it. Which maybe leaves us and you, the listener, with that final provocative thought Kelly raises implicitly.
Which is?
When we build complex societies, when we value stability and order and civilization, what price are we collectively willing to pay for it? And perhaps more importantly, who throughout history tends to be the one actually footing the bill?
A challenging question to ponder. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acoctra Foundation.